I would say that when television started to open up award shows to designers and make these designers something that were good exposure to homes, it became very well known that these are brands, you know, where before we used to hear of Gucci. Gucci was very, very expensive in France. But when designers started to come down to the level of award shows and got more exposure. But then again, the Kardashian effect.
Yeah.
The Kardashian girls who are media influencers, who are very out there in how much they talk about what they're wearing, what they're doing, makeup brands, their brands and the brands they support are in no way cheap.
Yeah.
And so because of them, there are other influencers who do the same thing. But the name recognition starts and people want to identify with being able to afford these brand names. And it gets to be very competitive and very difficult to reach, especially, you know, in people who are struggling to meet everyday needs. And if you are not in brand with others, essentially teens are excluded.
You're ostracized.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Which is terrible.
It's amazing how the Kardashians, they really were the first quote unquote influencers.
Yes.
I'm just learning about influence. Do you know about influencers, Steve?
I only barely.
So it's like these random people on social media, Instagram or whatever, just random people. Now, some of these people are famous for other reasons, but these are just random people who for some reason develop a following.
Huge following.
They'll get millions of people looking at their stuff every day. And they become influencers, so brands will pay them, not even to necessarily talk about it, but they'll just wear a hat with the brand on it, and kids will see it, and then they'll go buy it.
Wow.
But the Kardashians were probably the first influencers, even though they maybe didn't know what they were doing. Maybe they did know. I don't know.
Their mom knew. Their mom was very perceptive, very smart business person. And so they wore these things, like, you know, and then they developed their own brand. You know, they had very, very clear ideas of what they were doing. And then their pictures were splashed onto, you know, to magazines and to at other social media outlets, and they were wearing things, and those this became very popular and very.
But this is a real problem, though. Okay, let's say a teenage girl's coming to you for help. She's severely depressed, and one of the root causes of her depression is that she simply can't afford some of these brands that everyone else in her school is. There's nothing. I mean, how do you counsel someone out of that? She can't help what family she was born into or what her parents do for a living.
Yeah.
Or even if her parents are well off, maybe they don't want to spend money on whatever it is.
Yeah.
So what kind of coping skills can you help with that?
And this is where you have to let children understand where they are and engage them in finding who they are, what they're asking for, and what other things can be more meaningful as human beings.
Well, you and I and Steve know that.
Yeah.
And probably everyone in our generation knows that.
Right.
How do you, that younger generation does not know that.
Yeah. Why is the younger generation so gullible? You know, I'm sitting here thinking, this shirt, $12, Walmart.
That's right.
These shoes, you know, it's like, what up with this brand name thing? And I don't think I could name more than one Kardashian.
Well, that's what I'm saying about this whole thing. We don't even, how do we guide our kids through this when we're so out of it? We are the okay boomer. Not by our fault. That's just how we are.
Yeah.
And these kids are so different, right? The disconnect seems to be getting greater.
Absolutely.
How do we tell kids this is just stupid? Ignore it.
Yeah. And it's difficult to buy it. Yeah. And so remember, kids don't listen to news, don't learn much more from their environment. They're focused on the websites that they like. So that time of television watching or watching things together, they are more focused on the websites they want, on the YouTube videos they want, the movie sites they want. It is very selective, tailored to what their interests are. Mm. And so it becomes almost that you have to start educating children about what is outside in the world, other than just the material things, and can you substitute the time away from the social media, meaning reducing their time? I can sit on, if I had to see Facebook and Twitter, sometimes I have to catch myself because it takes about 30, 45 minutes, just gone. Just right. if you read and if you go through the all the feed that you have. And so they have more time. They have more time to kind of get lost in it.
Is there an addictive component to it?
Yes. Yes, there is a part of being addicted because they can't seem to separate. And that's where education at the very early age or redefining your connection with social media is absolutely important. I wouldn't say addiction per se as addiction we know it in terms of substances, but their focus. They will stay for hours. My parents will say, my daughter is not getting out of bed. But you ask them, what are you doing when you're in bed? My phone, I'm on my phone. Yeah. And you think, oh, how much of time gets to be used up by just being on the phone, and you're cutting out everybody you don't like and sticking to things that you would like to dream of or you would like to be part of. And how do we get our children to see the world around them? Think about volunteering opportunities. Yeah. Think about how do you get jobs? How do you get driving done instead of staying stuck to this interaction that can be positive, but mainly gets to be very negative because the person on the other side doesn't see you as a person, can make any kind of comments about your looks, your earrings, your necklace, your shoes, your clothes. It just becomes very challenging to their morale.
Yeah. So a lot of that's about getting the kids out into the real world as opposed to the cyber world, cyberspace to real space.
And I'd also like to somehow bring up in here that, you know, our children have gotten so much pressure from other forces, whether they're friends or non-friends. Send me pictures of yourself, and then splash in response to their call for love in quotation marks. If you love me, send me a picture of yourself. And those long-term effects that are remain in social media.
It doesn't go away.
Yeah. And they are looking for that response in terms of romance, in terms of acceptance, which ends up being very negative. And then when they have that hopelessness and helplessness, then they don't know anywhere to go but to do things that now are starting to fill up our emergency rooms because they have done something to hurt themselves, taking overdoses, doing things to hurt themselves that translate to a call for help, or that it is time to intervene and shut this down.
Yeah, yeah. And are those sort of difficulties really more common now than it was when we were kids? As far as people being, as far as teens being depressed or suicidal or overdosing, is that more common now than it used to be overall? Or
I can tell you that the CDC just released a report on how our suicide rate has increased. I think about 5 times, 5.6. I think it went up 5.6%, and it states that it went up about 56% because kids are starting to show up in emergency rooms. So suicide was the 10th most cause of death among Americans of all ages in 2017, but it is a leading cause of death, second leading cause of death in kids 15 to 24.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have they, I hate to put you on the spot, but have they done a study that is looking at the effects of social media on those suicidal kids?
I think there are small things that come here and there that, you know, you can do case reports and stuff. But, you know, what we term as studies are double blind placebo.
Right.
You know, and those are hard to do.
It's always going to be hard to prove cause and effect in something like this. But think of the amount of effort and national dialogue we have put into the 30 teenagers that died from e-cigarettes over the last year or 2 years.
Yeah, yeah.
but zero dialogue or national media attention on an increased suicide rate in these kids and not trying to get to the bottom of why they're committing suicide.
Yeah. Teenage depression's a big one.
Correct. Yeah. And so e-cigarettes brought that up and somehow has brought that conversation forward. We really need to be talking about this new CDC report because our children are ending up in emergency rooms and hurting themselves.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's a lot more to talk about. We'll be back right after a few messages here as the music fades in and I fade out. We're back. 97.1 FM Talk. This is the Eye on Health show. And we're here with Dr. Sakrani, and we're talking about teenage depression and teenage suicide and mental health and social media.
Gotta
love
it.
Too many things to talk about.
Gotta love the social media.
Right? Yeah. And I guess one thing we kind of touched on is just plain therapy. I mean, it's because I think a lot of times when kids are miserable, it's hard to say. Is it better thought of as a chemical imbalance and they need the right pill, or their life is messed up and they're miserable, or what's going on with the kid? You know,
yeah. I think it's all of the above.
Yeah,
it's not just parsed out to one or the other, and that's where a child psychiatrist does a good history. You know, it's not just look at, what happened? Okay, let me give you a prescription. You do a good history.
A
good history includes developmental history, what happened to the in the pregnancy, before pregnancy, in the actual delivery, and the first few years of development, any changes in lives, any delays, things like that. So it's good to take a good history. And the other part is a good family history. Mm-hmm. We are now starting to recognize that our parents, grandparents, had something going on, though we probably did not know diagnoses. We could say that our grandmother was in a facility and did not come home. We're not able to put the actual diagnoses, but know that sometime in our past there was something going on, and what was its effect. So family history, developmental history, you know, and of course a social history is very important. And a social history would mean, where was a child born, how old was the child when parents split up, did the parent leave the child and just abandon it, or did the child go into foster care, or for that matter, did the child move a lot? All these things have an impact on the child in the first few years of life.
Yeah.
Just because the child does not have the ability to talk doesn't mean it didn't have an impact. And so in order to develop understanding of what is going on, you have to understand the past and the present in order to come up with a good formulation and a treatment plan.
To kind of have a good understanding of the big picture. So,
exactly.
Am I true in assuming that depression knows no socioeconomic predilection, or is that wrong?
It is very true that depression knows no boundaries in terms of countries, in terms of gender. Okay. Of course, gender, we kind of identify the females more than the males, but
they may
across
just verbalize
board,
it more too.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, okay. Correct. Yeah.
But you really can't prejudge whether someone's going to get depression based on any of those factors, right? I mean, it could be, you could have the what we would all consider a perfect life and still be depressed.
Correct.
Is that
depression
right?
Is universal, meaning it crosses, it exists in all cultures. It is the effect of family history, the effect of not really genetics, but familial tendencies, because we haven't found a gene for depression. Yeah. So what is there a familial tendency towards depression? When we see depression in young kids who have no kind of social impact going on. We want to know, has depression come down generations? And it certainly has some bearing on that.
Partly genetic.
It can be genetic, familial, whatever way you would define it. And there is some socioeconomic impact on depression. You know, we say money can't buy happiness. When you are depressed because of having no job, no money, being in a poverty stricken area, there's lots that financial availability can do for you.
Yeah, the person that said money can't buy happiness is probably super rich, I'm guessing.
Correct.
Yeah, super rich and having a bad day.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think I asked you this off air, but when do you decide to put a teenager on medicine? And is it still controversial to put a teenager on these newer class of medicines, or is it pretty well accepted now?
I would say that it is very well accepted. It is very effective. We are in an age where medication is available, which is not having as many side effects as the older medication did. Of course, we know about the side effects of medications and how to care for them. When do we put kids on medication is when it gets in the way of function. So in the way of function, meaning function at school and function at home. And as much as possible, we have gotten to the point that we are developing mental health systems that can identify children. We now make available in schools depression screenings. Mm-hmm. Schools do depression screenings. Pediatricians do depression screenings. And if they're able to identify that there is depression moving along, they try to get kids engaged in some kind of mental health treatment, whether it's a group, whether it's a therapy, before they know that, hey, this needs a higher level of care.
Yeah. And I would think having a kid see a therapist is something that we know is going to be harmless. It's not as big of a jump as medication is.
Correct.
In a lot of people's minds. So, and I think a lot of times having a conversation with a therapist can be a huge help for a kid because they can have conversations they couldn't have with a parent or whatever. Yeah. Do those screenings work? Do you think? Do
they really identify? Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Our counselors in school are very active with screenings. And we are teaching our children to, if you see something, say something. And that is helpful because now we don't consider children anymore as snitches. If they hear something that somebody is struggling and is thinking about doing something, they get a counselor involved, they get a parent involved, and we are marching on with making sure that we train our kids in that and be very confident in saying something if they see something, because with that age-appropriate intervention, that can save the life of a child.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we could go on and on. But we can't go on and on because Chad keeps playing music.
That's right.
It's all his fault.
It's almost time to go out. But that was a lot of interesting stuff.
Thanks so much for coming.
Yeah, oh, it was my pleasure. Always my pleasure. Thank you for inviting.
You bet. Eye on Health. Out we go.